политика российской власти в отношении крымских татар и притеснение
иностранных дел России объяснили, почему преследует крымских татар.
В Крыму вновь пропал крымский татарин.
Крымские татары изначально ничего хорошего от России не ждали в силу исторических
Это все можно считать объявлением войны крымским татарам.
Petty harassment, raids on mosques, questionable prosecutions, extrajudicial abductions, torture, and even killings. 6 months after Russia's forceful annexation of Crimea from Ukraine, the peninsula's 250,000 Tatars are feeling the heat. Moscow initially tried to woo and co-opt Crimea's Tatar community. But when that effort fell flat, the Kremlin pivoted to its default setting, the tried-and-true application of force and fear. Does the campaign against the Crimean Tatars risk galvanizing and potentially radicalizing Russia's 5-million-strong Tatar community and turning the country's largest ethnic minority into opponents of the regime? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in our studio is Rim Golfanov, director of RFERL's Tatar Bashkir service. Welcome back, Rim.
Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. And joining me here in Prague is Mirhat Sharapjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom. Welcome, Mirhat.
Thank you.
And joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, guys.
Hey, after Edim Asanov, a Crimean Tatar missing since September 28th, was found dead this week, Human Rights Watch issued a report saying that Crimean Tatars and other opponents of the annexation have been, quote, forcefully disappeared, end quote, on the peninsula. Human Rights Watch said other Crimean Tatars have been found dead with signs of torture. Mustafa Jamilov and other Tatar leaders have been banned from the territory. The Mezhelis, the Tatar community's self-governing assembly, has been raided by armed, masked men. And Crimea's Moscow-installed de facto head, Sergei Aksionov, raised the specter of Joseph Stalin's 1944 deportation of the Tatars from the peninsula, saying it could all happen again. Rim, I just hit the highlights here, and I'm sure I've missed some things, but it appears the Kremlin is taking off the gloves with the Tatars. What are the implications in Crimea, and how is this playing for Tatars elsewhere in the Russian Federation?
I think the gloves were off already before the Moscow started this Crimean project, because it was clear that the Crimean Tatars, as the most politically active group in peninsula, would be the main force against Russian annexation, and it was...
But they tried to co-opt them at first.
They tried to corrupt them somehow. They engaged Kazan Tatar pro-Moscow government and a lot of people.
They tried to use the Kazan Tatars.
Yes, Kazan Tatars were in empire, as we call it, for quite long time already, few centuries. So the level of collaboration among Kazan Tatars is rather high. And the mentality of Kazan Tatar mentality is already very close to Russian mentality in this sense. So they tried to involve Kazan Tatars, they tried to buy them actually, offering different projects, but it did not work out. And then they just decided, I think, to try another level of working with Crimean Tatars, meaning intimidating them somehow. First, as you said, a few searches were conducted in madrasas, in religious schools, in ordinary schools, in Mejlis. Finally was sort of kicked out of the building. It was clear that the Mejlis, the main organization...
The self-governing assembly.
Yes, actually like they call it parliament, ethnic parliament, but it's actually a real working, functioning political organization. So now, given the Tatars remain the main pro-Ukrainian, or better to say, anti-Russian mm-hmm. force in Crimea. So they started to intimidate them. And so far, according to Medzlis, up to 18 Crimean Tatars disappeared. And just few of them were found and found dead, actually, mm-hmm. which is very...
How many really have been sad. Found dead?
So far, two of them. The first one, actually, in during the ahead of referendum, Shat Ametov, this is a famous case. And it was sort of signal. At least nobody could prove that he was killed by particular Russian troops or paramilitary troops headed by Aksyonov himself. But the signal was given to Tatars, and they got it right. If you are planning something against us, you will be just dead. So this is the start of that campaign, you can consider. And now, given that so many people are disappearing, the Crimean occupation authority decided to make this course more obvious.
Yeah, no, I mean, in Aksyonov's comments, they were in an interview in Kommersant that I saw, were pretty eye-popping, because to openly raise the specter of the Stalin-era deportations of the Crimean Tatars and saying, this could happen again. I mean, they're not exactly hiding their intentions. Mirkar, your thoughts on this?
Well, this is a part of a created situation when every Tatar is doing has to do self-censorship, I would say. Or, you know, everybody knows that the methods by the Kremlin used not only against Tatars, but also, let's say, in Chechnya and elsewhere. It's just a message not to the other part of Russia. It's a clear message to Tatars. We can do the same to you, and you just be careful.
Right. Now, Mark, a lot of these incidents, I mean, people being bundled into minivans by masked men and turning up with signs of torture or turning up either tortured or dead or both, bear the trademark of either security service black ops or organized crime actions, or perhaps both at the same time. You're our expert on both of these things, spooks and crooks. What does this look like to you? I mean, when you look at what's going on here in Crimea with the Tatars.
Yes, I think we're seeing several interconnected processes that do tend to bring up the extent to which the spook and crook dividing line in Russia is often distinctly hazy. On the one hand, absolutely, it's clear that Moscow is worried about the Crimean Tatars, that it's trying to put the screws on them at a pretty early point. And, I mean, let's face it, it signaled it quite early. I mean, back in June, FSB director Bortnikov, while claiming that a bomb attack in Crimea had been foiled, put it down to, and it's a useful quote here, crime bosses and the heads of various extremist groups, with the support of their foreign sponsors, are continuing to carry out plans to commit terrorist attacks in the Russian Federation. So we managed to roll together. When you talk about crime bosses, almost invariably Bortnikov means ethnic non-Russian crime bosses. He never seems to have a problem with the other sort. Heads of various extremist groups and foreign sponsors. He's basically rolled together the three classic enemies in the sort of the Russian trope. So on the one hand, absolutely, that this is a case of straightforward political repression. But it's also, I think, evident that there is a criminal dimension to this. Not necessarily because criminals are carrying out the attacks. They absolutely look like they're carried out by agents of the state. But the point is that the actual purpose, I think, is much more reflecting the shifts in the underworld within the Crimea. I mean, a lot of the raids that have been taking place in sort of various villages are often ostensibly drug busts, or we're looking for marijuana grows and that kind of thing. And what's happening is, we've seen this, that the Slavic gangs in the Crimea are trying to consolidate their position. And you have the arrival of the various, the Varangians, the sort of the groups from, the gangs from Moscow, building their alliances. It's clear that both the Tatars and, to a lesser extent, Chechen organized crime in the area is being given a very heavy-handed message. Appreciate your position in the criminal ecosystem. If you are going to operate, you have to operate accepting that it's the Slav gangs, which are closest to the regime, which are going to be the dominant ones. So I think in this respect, it's actually a case of trying to assert Muscovite control in both the upper and the underworld.
Yeah, these are two parallel processes going on at the same time. Right. On the one hand, the political repression, but there's a parallel repression going on of the Tatar underworld by the Slavic underworld. Rim, you indicated you want to jump in here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the very nature of Russian state overall reminds me criminal gang activity, you know, because they function according to the same rules, I mean, they respect the same authorities, and the behaving based actually as the criminal groups are functioning, I mean, in Russian, higher Russian state apparatus. So in this sense, it's nothing surprising. I mean, they just continue behaving as they behaved before. And speaking about the Tatars in Crimea, I mean, I think it's clear now that Moscow decided if it will pursue that Crimea will remain as a part of Russia. I mean, I think they are all 100% sure that the Crimea will stay within Russia. So they have to again implement this old Tsarist policy, Crimea with no Tatars. And they can use different ways to reach that, starting with killing Tatars, then forcing them to immigrate, banning from entering Crimea for
Tatar leaders, more proactivist.
Yeah. So we are just witnessing this implementation of this policy.
But do you see the Tatars leaving Crimea?
Not all the Tatars, but active Tatar, pro-independent or pro-Ukrainian, anti-Russian.
Which is the vast majority of Tatars,
So far. And of course, I mean, some part might be, I don't know, the half of the Tatars, or I don't know, maybe slightly half, will be somehow given some positions, some businesses.
Co-opted.
Yeah,
so. Although they tried that once and it didn't work. It just didn't work.
Well, it works slowly, but it works. I mean,
after this intimidation, it might work a little better, perhaps.
Yes, because, you know, the life is going on. They have to keep their life, and, you know, it's just they are normal human beings. And
right. Mark, Mark, and then Mirka. Mark just indicated he had something to add to there, and then I'll go right to you, Mirka. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I confess I don't see signs at this stage that the Russians are moving towards a, shall I say, I hate to use the expression, but a final solution to the Crimean Tatars in terms of pushing them out. But I do think it says something about the distinctiveness of the Crimean adventure, which is precisely the extent to which, right from the beginning, the Russians use local organized crime as an instrument. In a way that sort of we see elsewhere in Russia, but much, much less strikingly and much, much less as a policy, shall we say. Here, as a policy, they went to use the gangsters as local tools. And in a way, that means two things. One is there are IOUs to be paid back, that in a way the organized crime now expects something from the Russian state. But secondly, it's much more now in the Kremlin's interests to precisely make sure that the Slavic organized crime gangs dominate. So this is an additional weird layer. Mm-hmm. It's that for the first time, you know, whereas usually basically organized crime is told, look, you know, just as long as you don't mess with the government, just do your own thing. Now you actually have a case in the Crimea where the Kremlin is actually on the side of one of the organized crime groupings, which is inevitably going to basically mean it does drive Tatar organized crime towards, if not an alliance with Tatar nationalism, but certainly a confluence of interests.
That's it. And this shouldn't be surprising if you listen to the podcast. God, it must have been 6 months ago, Mark, when we were talking about the pre-annexation state of Crimea. We had Marikot and Mark both were on that podcast, where Crimea under Ukraine was riddled with organized crime because of the neglect that the Ukrainian state had toward it. So this shouldn't be surprising at all. Marikot, you had something you
I just wanted to mention one more thing, which is very important. We're talking about Crimean Tatars, about those Crimean Tatars who returned to Crimea. Mm-hmm. This nation went through a huge filter. Those who were devoted their lives, whole their lives, and left this message to the other generations to come back. Those Tatars who survived the deportation and lived in Central Asia, they lived very, very, very good lives there. Mm-hmm. In the 70s, 80s, they were having very good niches in Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan. They had their own big houses, and they were in businesses around there.
So they were doing well in Central Asia.
Yeah, they were doing well. They were not doing very well in the beginning of the deportation, but in the late years of the Soviet Union, they were doing fine. But they decided to come back. And now I don't think that any of them is eager to go away, because there was a golden dream of several generations to go back. And this, many of them assimilated. The Stalin's Tatar, Crimean Tatar language is so close by culture. This nation is so close to Central Asia. So many of them assimilated among Uzbeks, Kazakhs, and others.
And remain, you know, do many, how many remain in Central Asia now?
Oh, there are almost none of them.
Uh-huh.
And those who are still Crimean Tatars, but they do not call themselves Crimean Tatars, but call themselves Uzbeks or Kazakhs, they already assimilated. And we're talking about the part of the Tatars who preserved their Crimean Tatarness and decided to go back no matter what. They lost a lot. And when they came there, the Ukrainian state ignored them to such an extent, they didn't have anything there.
No, there is some culpability for the negligence of the Ukrainian state here, because it allowed organized crime to flourish in Crimea, because they neglected it so much, and it left the door open.
It was actually indifferent, and the Ukrainian state, which is now strongly supporting Crimean Tatars, but it's a little bit late, I'm sorry. But nevertheless, the Crimean Tatars, they appreciate Ukrainian state just because of that. It gave at least the freedom for them to fight for their place in Crimea. But now they face just tremendous obstacles from Russian authorities, even in terms of this freedom.
And where this might go next, and to get the ball rolling on that, I wanted to listen to an audio cut from the Council of Europe's Human Rights Commissioner, Nils Muzhnieks. He was speaking on October 1st during a session of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. Let's listen.
My biggest concern, to be honest, is the situation of the Crimean Tatars, a population with a very tragic history. There's an urgent need to strengthen their sense of security, which has been shattered by a series of raids by armed masked security personnel in religious institutions, schools, Tatar-owned businesses, private homes, and after my visit to the Majlis, their assembly. The ostensible goal of the searches was to search for weapons or so-called extremist literature. Now, the Crimean Tatars have no history of violence or extremism, and their raids are completely disproportionate and should be stopped.
Now, Rim, he's right here. The Crimean Tatars do, to my knowledge, have no history of violence. But one has to ask the question, could that change if this continues?
Well, I don't expect that Crimean Tatars will choose the armed struggle against occupation, because, they do understand their situation. They are not that numerous in Crimea. It's about 1/10, 1/15 part of the population, though they are very active. And the second thing, they do remember that during Soviet times, what helped to survive, what helped to keep the Crimean Tatars united, it was not armed struggle. It was just this motivation to return home. So if even some armed conflict appear in Crimea, I would see it in connection with religious groups. There are some militant extremist radical groups inside the Crimean Tatar Muslim community, and I even don't expect they start something, but Russians could provoke. And Russians are good in this, given their experience in Chechnya, in Tatarstan, for example. They keep talking about the rise of Wahhabism, radicalism among Muslim population, but actually they themselves provoke it somehow to the extent that they use some agents, double agents, inside this religious group. So I think Moscow can decide on some point that it's time to escalate a little bit situation just to keep...
Which would give them the pretext to do what they want to do.
Yes, to further intimidate the Tatar population.
What about, now Mark was talking about this organized crime element, and if the non-Slavic gangs, including the ethnic Tatar gangs, are pushed into an alliance with the Tatar nationalists, could that become combustible?
Well, one can compare the Crimean Tatar activities to the way how organized crime functions, but I think the main difference here is that the main motivation is different.
Mm.
It's for Crimean Tatars, it's not connected to their material, to their financial interest. It's purely, first of all, it's this emotional thing, mm. being in motherland, in homeland. Of course, I mean, Tatars are not that naive people. Of course, they have the business interest as well. But it's not primarily like they don't function mm-hmm. like criminal group over there. So, which I cannot say about the pro-Russian groups. I'm not just familiar with the what kind of motivation, what kind mm-hmm. of work they do. Of course,
that's why we have Mark.
Yeah, Sergei Aksyonov. He's head of the Crimea now, and at the same time, he heads this.
He was head of one of the larger criminal gangs in Crimea before.
Yeah,
before.
And he has his paramilitary groups under him.
Mark, would you agree? Do you think that even given that the Crimean Tatars are being pushed to the brink right now, and even given that maybe if the Tatar criminal groups are getting squeezed by the Slavic groups, and at the same time the Tatar political activists are getting squeezed, is this a combustible mixture that can turn this into a more violent struggle?
Well, I would certainly agree with Rin that we're not actually heading towards a situation where we see Crimean Tatars as a whole, as some kind of mass movement rising up or whatever. But I think the prospect for small-scale, essentially terrorist actions is not impossible. And we've got to bear in mind that there is a bit of a pedigree. I mean, back in 2009, when it was still under Ukrainian control, the local interior minister, Moscow, was warning about the influx of sort of Wahhabist extremists from particularly Uzbekistan. And the SBU have been cracking down on representatives of sort of movements like Al-Takfir and Hizb ut-Tahrir, precisely claiming that they, and catching, finding a few arms caches and this, that, and the other.
And this was the Ukrainian authorities, so we can
exactly.
give a little bit more credence to that than we would give to the...
Yeah.
The Russians always raise this flag, but...
Exactly, but this is it. I mean, so, and there were, one can always say, it was criminal guns or whatever, but nonetheless, there does seem to have been evidence of at least a few people. And I think this, for me, is the particular issue, because you don't have to have, a mass movement. You need a few people who perhaps then, manage to launch an attack or even a potential attack. And it's not so much that Moscow then has a pretext, because frankly, Moscow never needs a pretext. This is one reason I'm always a little skeptical about the agent provocateur line. If Moscow wants to crack down, Moscow cracks down. It's more that just if you have a few Crimean Tatars doing something like this, Moscow will overreact the way Moscow always does. And that, for me, is the real risk. It's that, a few people on one side have an attack, Moscow overreacts, and in the process pushes more and more Crimean Tatars into the hands of some form of radicalism that need not be jihadist at all, but some kind of political radicalism that begins to sharpen the tensions at work.
So they don't even need a false flag or a provocation to do this. The natural course of events could just play into their hands this way?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't think it's anyone... I mean, if Moscow wants to do bad things, Moscow does bad things.
And
we've
has
seen
done
that.
Bad things.
Exactly. I think the idea that... this is why I'm always a little sceptical about the whole sort of false flag type thing, sort of suggestions, because I just don't think it's necessary. And Pierre Vicanal will happily report whatever it wants anyway. I think it is more that just simply, that is the natural dynamic. Moscow tends to be phenomenally clumsy in dealing with what it regards as potential security threats, and tends to be phenomenally clumsy when it's dealing with non-Russian nationalities. And once it's gone through its limited palette, as we've already heard about, you know, basically trying to bribe community leaders and hoping that people will go away, then it tends to, as you put it in the initial introduction, you know, go back to its usual playbook, which tends to be a very heavy-handed one.
Now, Mark, I want to put you on the spot now just because you're smart and you're good on things like this. But, I mean, you've studied insurgencies. You're a security expert and you're familiar with the territory. If you were advising the Crimean Tatars about how to handle this situation, what would you tell them?
Well, certainly this is the worst place to have an insurgency. You know, it's certainly you can't have any kind of a rural insurgency, and an urban one. Well, you're a potentially sort of visibly identifiable small minority in a place where the Russians have a hell of a lot of security forces and can surge in a lot more. Whatever one may say about the Russian security apparatus, they're good on the basic nuts and bolts of grabbing people, bringing them in, kicking the snot out of them until they tell them what they want to hear, and then moving on. So, I mean, I think that if the Crimean Tatars are going to resist, it's actually going to have to be with the whole sort of postmodern sort of approach of big public displays, occasional targeted strikes, trying to ridicule the authorities rather than anything else. I mean, at the moment, the issue is that there is no constituency to support the Crimean Tatars. Kazan is not interested. The outside world, frankly, is not interested. And it's too easy to paint them precisely as dupes of jihadists. So that's what they need to address first.
So passive resistance and kind of a postmodern campaign is about the only option before them right now. Merkad, any thoughts here?
It's going to be very difficult. The Crimean Tatars always were struggling using the peaceful means. I just remember what Zafinar Jamilova said, a wife of Mustafa Jamilov, who was present at the burials of Edem Asanov this week. She said, when we were fighting and struggling for our rights during Soviet time, there were some rules, regulations. Now there is no rules. And I understand her. Of course, during the Soviet time, there was no Majlis. There was no need to present somebody as a jihadist, right, or Islamist or anything. The completely different situation. In this new realities, I'm afraid Tatars, of course, they have to continue fight for their rights and struggle, but I think the situation is going to be much worse than it used to be, because Russia has to use completely new methods. Methods different from the Soviet time, at least for the Soviet time what we grew up in Brezhnev, Zastoy period and stuff. But it's going to be very tough. And rules, regulations changed because criminal elements, criminal methods are there. People are kidnapped, they're tortured, they're found dead. It's a message. That was not like that during in 70s or, 60s, right after deportation. It's a completely different world, and it's very hard to give any advice here.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rim, it's a pretty bleak picture for the Tatars if you look at this. But on the other hand, I mean, the Crimean Tatar community has been very good at persevering despite the odds over the years. How do you see this playing out?
I think it all depends. I mean, the first winter will decide what will the situation in Crimea. So far, why? I think Kremlin's escalated with this intimidation campaign. They need to do some work before the situation in Crimea deteriorates.
Over the winter,
yeah. You see now that forget tourism.
Right.
Forget this countrywide proudness about Crimea Krim Nash. The only thing the Moscow can do now with Crimea is transform it into big fortress Krim, make it a big military zone with the Black Sea Fleet and the permanent posing permanent danger to Ukraine, with potentially could become a normal democratic state. So there is no place for anti-Russian Tatars in this scheme. Right. So that's why they decided to act more actively with Tatar population. And I think they are still capable to do, because they continue this social engineering projects, you know, which Stalin starts sometimes ago. And the only thing, I think, that the community will remain strong. I just do believe in it, because they have history, because they have conscience, because they have a strong identity. Mm.
Well, when we had you on 6 months ago, when we were initially talking about the Crimean Tatar issue right after the annexation, one of the things we talked a lot about was the relationship between the Kazan Tatars, the Volga Tatars, and the Crimean Tatars. And at the time, you were skeptical that, and you expressed this earlier on in the program today, that the Volga Tatars, the Kazan Tatars, would be support, could be used in support of the Crimean Tatars, and with some exceptions, you've been proven to be pretty much right. Although there have been cases of Kazan Tatars, this activist who was given a 1-year suspended sentence for posting on Facebook a message in support of the Crimean Tatars. How do you see this now? I mean, has anything changed, or has anything surprised you in the way the Kazan Tatars have approached this?
Actually, nothing, because I mean, the Fawzia Bayramova who you are talking about, I think just few people among Kazan Tatars who genuinely support Crimean Tatar cause understand their situation. But otherwise, the majority is like all Russia. I mean, it's a big madhouse now. And Kazan will continue working with this collaborative Crimean Tatars. Mm. They are doing this. I don't know, some cooperation between museums, schools, high schools will continue, but no political cooperation, nothing like that.
In some ways, doesn't that surprise you? Because in the years before the annexation, and I mean, God, you and I have sat in how many editorial meetings where this would come up, and we'd do stories about it, about the, you know, the language rights issue and the issue of educational curriculum in Tatarstan, the whether you can call the republic's leader a president or not. I mean, it seems that Moscow has been chipping away consistently at the hard won rights that Tatars won in the 90s, and that. Why isn't this provoking any kind of a backlash? And now you have the issue of the Crimean Tatars on top of all that, and it's still not provoking a backlash.
Because it's done all very intelligent. It's all combined, you know, and they do something on legislative level, for example. There are certain people, there are people responsible for this. They banned this switching to Latin alphabet, for example, and different level is working on security level. Mm-hmm. They are just fighting against more or less independently minded people, activists, among whether they try to corrupt them or just to get rid of them. Another group or another level of working is on religious front. Mm-hmm. You know, they are fighting the so-called Wahhabis. So Moscow, very consistent. Moscow has a policy on this.
A strategy. Even.
Strategy. It's returning back to this Ushakov's triangle, samodержавие, православие, народность. So at least as far as, so they are complaining there is no nationwide ideology in modern Russia. Actually it is. It's still a Russification as much as possible with one language. Which is going on with great success. If it's possible with one church or with other religious groups who are strongly pro-government, which is done, almost done. Right. So Moscow does its work very, very consistently.
Mm. One more element here is fear. I'm sure among Volga Tatars or Kazan Tatars, there are many who are just feared. They sympathize to Crimean Tatars, but they don't say that.
Yeah.
And those who support Fawzia Bayramova in Tatarstan and elsewhere across Russia, there are many of them. Yushevsky today, the last Bolotnaya case defendant, was sentenced today, and he pleaded guilty. It's not only about ethnic groups. Everybody's scared in Russia, in Russian Federation. And this is a part of the whole story. Mm. I think, I remember, I grew up in the Soviet Union, at the ethnic minority representing a Muslim population there. We all supported each other, and we still continue. We can say one thing. We could say one thing publicly, but in the kitchen. But today, what's happening in Russia, I think all the real ideas, attitudes, and opinions are shared in the kitchens. Mm-hmm. And if something happens, if the system in Russia changes, I'm sure the majority of Kazan Tatars will say Crimea is Crimean Tatars.
Right.
That's
and we
situation.
Always supported them, even though we were silent.
Yeah, yeah, that's the situation. We just have to remember that today's Russia is not Russia, which used to be under Yeltsin.
Right.
That's all.
Mark, any thoughts?
Yes. One thing I would say in terms of the notion of Russia having a strategy is it's interesting that although the Crimean Interior Ministry, the new chiefs are all, you know, are both locals, just simply sort of bumped up in position, the FSB, you know, brought in an outsider to head the Crimean FSB, Viktor Palagin, who up to that point had been the head of the FSB directorate in Bashkiria. 25% Tatar republic. And again, I mean, I think they chose someone precisely whom they reckon, shall we say, majors in dealing with not just ethnic issues, but particularly sort of
Tatar
and potentially sort of Muslim issues, rather than because they're worried about Ukrainian spies or anything else. I mean, given the FSB has this sort of multifunctional role, it always says something, the kind of person that they bring in to head up any particular local directorate.
Mm. Well, it's good that Mark brought up this Palagin, because it's a very interesting personality, actually. Exactly as he worked in Bashkortostan, in Bashkiria, these Wahhabi cases appeared over there. Few armed conflict. I mean, incidents happened in Bashkortostan, in Oktyabrsky, and in some way in Ural Mountains region. So Palagin actually knows how to do that kind of things. Immediately as he left, all these incidents also ended.
Stopped, interestingly enough.
Yeah, and because new president was brought up.
Right.
So Moscow had no interest, didn't need anything like that. It was done.
Right.
So now he appeared in Crimea. So that's why I'm talking that Moscow possibly can plan something.
So you might be expecting some provocations.
Yeah, trigger some conflicts in Crimea.
I wanted to kick it out even farther now and make it a little bit broader before we move on to the second half very quickly. But it was a lead editorial in Nezavisma Gazeta last week on October 6th. And it argued that, quote, injustice toward Muslim believers could lead to violence in Moscow and other Russian cities. A similar conclusion was reached in a new report by the Moscow Center for the Study of National Conflicts on Interethnic Tension in the Russian Federation. Now, neither of these things really talked about the Crimean Tatars per se. But with given Russia's problems with the Muslim population, they've been largely centered on the North Caucasus. When you add into that the issue of the Tatar, the Kazan Tatars, who have grievances of their own, and now the Crimean Tatar issue, you would think that this forms a kind of a combustible cocktail. Right. You have three different distinct groups of broadly defined distinct groups, the North Caucasus Muslims, which are many different ethnic groups, of course, but we tend to lump them together. You have the Kazan Tatars and the Crimean Tatars. You have all this together. You would think that this would create a rallying point for Russian Muslims in general. It doesn't have to be jihadism. It doesn't have to be violent. It doesn't but you would think that this would lead to some kind of organized fraternal opposition to the regime. But yesterday I was talking off mic with Aslan Dokhaev, the director of our North Caucasus service, and he said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. There's no solidarity there whatsoever. Rim, would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree in this because, you know, there are different groups and Moscow knows how to work with them. Mm-hmm. Historically, Moscow has good experience or has had good experience working with Bukhara Emirate, you know, during mm-hmm. Tsarist times, Chechens or Azeris and Kazan Tatars. So it will be just continuation of the policy. But as soon as the power in Moscow will start to weaken, all these conflicts will rise. Mm-hmm. And in this, and then I can expect some solidarity, showing some solidarity, some uniting, mm-hmm. even probably. But otherwise, the main thing in Russia is as long as central government is strong, has petrodollars, everything is good.
Petrodollars are becoming less dollars, yes, as the price of oil tanks.
Now, but petrorubles. Yeah,
given sanctions, I mean, we can reach that point, but it's really, I wouldn't like to speculate.
So paradoxically, not until the regime weakens, we'll see. Now, Mirka, you and I were talking off mic yesterday, and you have a little bit of a different
picture. I have a different, because, different well...
We'll let Mark play Solomon.
Rim mentioned that if situation in the Kremlin changes, it all probably lead to consolidation and stuff. But it cannot happen like this. It goes, and it has been there for many centuries. This year, I mean this month, first 500 Chechens are going to be recruited to the Russian army. For the first time in the last 20 years, it was announced. Whatever tough guys they are, they're going to the Russian army and they're ethnic Chechens. You just can't imagine what, after these two Chechen wars, what the attitude to them, if they are sent to Siberia or Ural Mountains or elsewhere. Guess who's going to support them there? Among officers and among sergeants, among elder soldiers?
Other Muslims.
Other people who are Tatars. Well, I was in the Soviet army. I remember that. Every morning when we had a breakfast, if I was sitting on the edge, it was my turn to distribute food. Every Muslim or non-Russian was getting more from me. That was, it's there, it always been there, it will always be there. As soon as the things changes, you know, how all of a sudden when the perestroika led to break of the Soviet Union, how all of a sudden everybody started, you know, my father came to Lithuania. I remember in 86 when the first anti-Kremlin riot took place in Almaty in 1986. Mm-hmm. Days after that, my father traveled to Lithuania, to Vilnius, for the conference of writers. When people, the taxi drivers, learned that he was a Kazakh, everything was for free. You know, and this is after perestroika. Before perestroika, probably wouldn't be possible.
Right.
But it cannot happen just like this. It's right there. The solidarity.
So it's late.
Solidarity is there. Look, another thing is, in the Volga area, we have many ethnic groups of Finnish-Ugric origin. For instance, we have Udmurts. We have our brother Turks, Chuvash. We have Mari, Komi, right, you name it, Cheremis, others. And where are they? The majority of them don't speak their language. Right. Many of them have, all of them have Russian names. Their children speak Russian. They don't speak their own language. They are Orthodox Christians, and all of them consider themselves Russians already. The only thing which could stand solidly against Russification and then Sovietization was Islam. Mm. I'm not talking about jihadists or right, something else. I'm talking about, you know, the only strongest ethnic group in the Volga area is Tatars. Even though there were attempts to baptize them and Russify them, you know, they were very stubborn. And this is what, they don't go five times, they don't pray five times, and they don't go to mosque, they drink vodka, you know, and stuff.
But still have this identification.
Yeah, because to be a Muslim in this empire means I'm not a Russian.
Right.
Doesn't mean that you are a practicing Muslim. I'm a Muslim. This is my right, ethnic group. Mm-hmm. And this is what unites Chechens, Tatars, not on a political agenda. There are no official organizations uniting them, but they are sympathy to each other. And this sympathy is there. If nations like Crimean Tatars went through all these filters and all this, torturing past, and they survived, many of them assimilated. Mm-hmm. Many of them, gave up. But those who remained,
right,
they're going to be very strong.
No, you would think, the common experience of the Crimean Tatars and the Chechens with the deportation, that itself would provide some kind of solidarity. Mark, what do you think? You've been listening to this. Do you have any thoughts here?
Well, I suppose I'm a little more skeptical about the sense that Muslim really can, or indeed that we should think of it as something that should provide this sort of overarching common identity as such. In a way that, especially if one looks at, for example, the North Caucasus, where one does have, a wide range of sort of common experiences, but a very, very distinct absence of common solidarity. The interesting thing is that there we do see, the rise of insurgent movements who are very, very definitely based in particular constituent republics. Yes, of course, there is a common experience of being the underdog. And yes, that's one reason why, there is that sort of sense of some kind of sort of shared affinity. But whether that's really strong enough to become activated, to become something positive, because actually, if, for example, we see a weaker Kremlin, that's when you precisely get the squabbles for who's going to pick up the spoils. Mm. And conversely, if we see a stronger Kremlin, well, the stronger Kremlin is also one that's more able to co-opt. Nationalism is, after all, often something that is used. It is employed by elites in their competitions. It's employed by elites to mobilize constituencies. And actually, whether these elites would be interested in trying to sort of activate some kind of pan-Muslim, pan sort of Republican or whatever Muslim identity, or whether it actually would be in their interest to say, no, we of the Kazan Khanate or whatever, have our own very specific identity. Mm. So, I think we shouldn't confuse a sense of just, yes, being thoroughly alienated from a Russian Slavic regime that is increasingly resting on very Slavic cultural tropes. That is a common identity, but it's a little bit like saying, how come all the various elements of Europe that are annoyed with the European Union haven't really found some kind of meaningful alliance? They have congresses for these various weird nutjob parties, but it's not actually as if they have any kind of meaningful common identity. And precisely, if it looked as if the European Union was about to fall apart, they'd be squabbling for national interests rather than anything else.
Well, this is an issue we're certainly going to keep our eye on. In a few moments, we'll shift gears and look at some of the wacky ways Russians marked Vladimir Putin's 62nd birthday and what this says about Russia today. I'd like to remind you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me in our studio is Rim Golfanov, director of RFRL's Tatar Bashkir service. Also with me here in Prague is Mirhat Sharabjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFRL's Central Newsroom. And on the Skype line from New York City is Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFRL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The children's musical group Petrushki singing Happy Birthday to Russia's President. One of the many sycophantic tributes to Vladimir Putin, who celebrated his 62nd birthday this week on October 7th. There was an art exhibition in Moscow titled The 12 Labors of Putin, modeled on the ancient Greek myth, the 12 Labors of Hercules. There was street art dedicated to Putin in seven Russian cities. There was a fashion show in St. Petersburg featuring clothing with Putin's image. And an estimated 100,000 people took to the streets in the Chechen capital Grozny, a city Putin once bombed mercilessly, to sing his praises. Putin was everywhere. He was on the wall. He was in your headphones. He was even on your clothes. The actual Putin, of course, was out of sight on his birthday, spending it in solitude in the Siberian taiga, where he was no doubt doing manly things. But the cult of personality was omnipresent. Rim and Mirhat, you both grew up in the Soviet Union, where portraits of Brezhnev were omnipresent. But this is this is a bit much even for that period, is it not? I mean, the cult of the personality was kind of a thing of the past in a formal sense by then. But how would you?
It's much ridiculous in this case because
this is more ridiculous than Brezhnev.
I don't remember myself singing songs on Brezhnev, for example,
no.
Or carrying his, I don't know, his pictures. Well, of course, it was a tradition to quote him somehow, to say that Brezhnev said that. Otherwise, I saw no Brezhnev in my life. But yeah. With Putin, it's really getting really bizarre.
Merkag,
I would say in the Soviet period, it was a taboo to know anything about how they spend their time
on their birthday. Here the Kremlin announced it. I mean, not my little quip about manly things, but
now it's different. And unfortunately, we just didn't grow up during the Soviet time only, but we also are witnessing what's happening in Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, especially Kazakhstan. Well, I think what Putin is doing there right now, or what people are doing about Putin there right now, it's the ugliest variant of what's happening in Central Asia today. So it's not when we compare with Russia with the Soviet past, we have to not compare only with Russia and the Soviet Union. Just look next door in Kazakhstan, or their monuments. You know, like 15, 20 years ago, it was very hard to believe that there will be something like that. Right. Nazarbayev was a completely different politician today, you know.
Yeah. Putin took a lot of his cues from Nazarbayev in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and him and you know, we all laughed at Turkmenbashi saying, well, how are you guys living there in Turkmenistan?
Now he named the month of May after his mother, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the month's names were changed, the weekdays' names were changed, you know, like, you know, that was crazy.
Even Quran was changed.
Yeah, the thing is that what is Putin is doing now is very close to what's happening in Central Asia in the last 20 years.
So the model's not the Soviet Union, it's more North Korea? Is that what you're saying in terms of this? This reminded me, I don't know if any, you all must remember, back in 2007 as Putin was leaving the presidency and they had this huge rally in Tver for the national leader. Remember this whole propaganda campaign of Putin, the national leader, which happened just as Putin was leaving the presidency. And it was mind blowing. I remember I saw our colleague Pavel Butorin was like cutting audio from this. And he was muttering under his breath and words that I can't say on the air. And I said to Pavel, what's up? He's like, you know, I grew up under Brezhnev and we all knew it was BS. These people seem to believe it.
Yeah.
You know, these people seem to believe it. Mark, what does this signify about Putin? I mean, this birthday was over the top. I've watched a lot of Putin birthdays over the year. This year was over the top.
Yes, I greatly regret missing it. That was, alas, a one-day art event. I think the thing is, I mean, it's you know, if one draws the parallel between Putin and the sort of the Brezhnev thing, apart from the fact that obviously it does bring up the extent to which it's always difficult to create a cult of personality when there is little personality there. But more to the point, back in the day, Brezhnev was not just an individual. He was, in some ways, at the time, the avatar of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. So there was the man, and then there was the institution. Now we have no institutions. You know, all that's left in modern Russia is precisely this fixation on the man, the national leader. And, you know, as soon as you get to national leader, I also hear Duce and Führer and such like. Not because this is fascism, I think that's important to stress, but because it draws on many of the same sort of populist wellsprings. And in that respect, it goes back to not just sort of Central Asia, but again, Tsarism. If one thinks about how the Tsarist system was conceptualized and legitimated, it was precisely that you had one person who was the national focus, one person who was the representative of the divine, one person who was church and state and society all in a single corporeal vessel. And we think how ridiculous, how antiquated, but that's where we are now. Putin is a representative of Russian national glory. Putin is the representative of the Russian state in all its sort of brutal omnipresence. And Putin is also meant to be the archetypal idealized Russian man. there is that sense of, well, what is left? At what point do you begin to hit that tipping point into what even Russians would begin to see ridiculous? But he certainly hasn't hit it yet.
No, apparently not. But, I mean, you make a good point that this is not fascism, but it does signal a shift in something that's been coming up in this podcast again and again and again, the shift from a soft authoritarian, Surkovian managed democracy to a hard authoritarian system, no? Is this not a symptom of that?
It can be. I mean, one could argue that in some ways the whole populist shtick might actually push aside some of the need for hard authoritarianism. You know, if enough people believe it.
Right.
You know, because after all, even the most authoritarian regime would rather you were happy than that you were unhappy but coerced into obedience.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, I don't think one can necessarily draw that parallel, but what I would make are two points. One is that it makes it easier to become authoritarian simply because you have no checks and balances, and to criticize Putin is to criticize everything about the system. But secondly, again, we come back to this point sort of in different ways has come up before about brittleness. Where is the succession? Where are the other structures? The more you build your entire system around one guy, mm-hmm. the more it becomes dependent on that. And I think it was quite funny that actually Putin sort of reportedly said after his sort of lengthy taiga hike for his birthday that everything still aches. And I was thinking, how can you begin to allow mortality and human frailty to begin to creep in here? When you have put everything right. on the line on Putin's omniscience, his never being wrong, the fact that he is this sort of virile superhuman.
Well, I don't know if any of you saw today, I got a public opinion poll, or I put public opinion poll in quotation marks by the Fond Общественного Мнения, the FOM, the pro-Kremlin public opinion foundation, came out today and asked this question: when do you think was the most democratic period in Russia's 1,000-year history? You know what number one was? Putin's third term. Putin's third term, 27%. You know what was in second place?
Brezhnev.
No, Putin's first two terms.
Oh. Okay.
Brezhnev was third.
Okay.
Brezhnev was third. The Yeltsin era, for all its faults, which I'm sorry, was more democratic than the Brezhnev era. I think any reasonable person would say that. It got only 7% said that. 2% said that. 3% said the Gorbachev period. The time when possibly the only free and fair presidential election in the history of the Russian Federation took place, the election on June 16th, 1991, that elected Boris Yeltsin president.
You remember that during Ukrainian crisis, Merkel said that Putin lives in different reality. But now the whole country lives in different reality. It's a sign of that, you know. And it's the main problem of all dictators have. They create a beast. They think control somehow, but on some point the beast starts behaving
out of control.
Doesn't this, though, another thing that came to my mind about this, the over-the-topness on Putin's birthday was, doesn't this point to some kind of deep insecurity in this regime?
He feels it. He knows it. Yep.
Definitely. I mean, I think this is, you have to realize that actual real popularity does not need to be reinforced, does not need to be trumpeted, does not need to be turned into a sort of a massive display. And also the ratchet principle, that good old Soviet sort of tool of economics, applies. Well, okay, what happens next? So you have these particular sort of grand birthday jamboree. Can you scale back, or do you actually have to always be sort of pushing the envelope further?
Well, yeah, they've dialed it up to 11. I don't know if it's possible to dial it up to 12. Anybody got any last thoughts before we wrap it up for this week?
Well, the only thing is I just want to say that today, I think today the major Kremlin news agency said that, well, Putin had to cover almost 10 kilometers in taiga. That's why his body is, they kind of explaining how even people close to God can have aching muscles,
right,
because they walk 10 kilometers in one day.
And I would add that the official Russian news agency is no longer called ITAR-TASS. It's just called TASS.
TASS,
now,
yes.
And on that note, we will wrap it up for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in our studios has been Rim Gilfanov, director of RFERL's Tatar Bashkir service. Also with me here in Prague has been Merhat Sharapjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom. And on the Skype line from New York City has been my co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thank you all for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Konchova, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and the newly launched Power Vertical feed at rferl.org. And you could follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.